Blog Talk Radio.
This is Patty Holstrand, and this is KWOD Radio, and we're on live today. And we got Jonathan Maxwell back with us today, and we're going to talk about his other book, The Murderous Intellectuals. We had talked to him probably about a month ago about his other book, and so we are definitely going to focus on he wanted to talk more about The Murderous Intellectuals, which is also a book that he had gotten an award for, with 2011 All Books Review Editor's Choice Award in the category of Best Nonfiction Book. His second book, Pull Down Man, which is the one that we talked about the other day, and Pull Down Man and Other Hoaxes, has recently been debuted and is lighthearted examination of scientific frauds through history. Obviously, the first book is definitely going to be a lot heavier. Are you there, Jonathan?
Yes.
Hey, Jonathan, how are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. Now, I know we talked before, but some people may not have heard any information about you, so introduce yourself for us.
Well, there's not much to say, really. I've always loved books, and I've always loved writing. I have a BA in English from Berry College, and I'm currently getting my Master's of English at Jacksonville State in Alabama. And Murderous Intellectuals actually came out in November of 2009, and Piltdown Man, the follow-up, came out in April of this year. So I've been pretty busy.
Well, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. And we're going to talk more about what your next stuff is coming up. But we have talked quite a bit about Piltdown Man, so explain to our viewers what that book's about.
Well, it's a look at scientific frauds through history. I touch upon such subjects as Bigfoot, Loch Ness, the Abominable Snowman, sea monsters, crop circles, a whole variety of things. The book, it stemmed from my lifelong interest in such subjects. I've always been interested in this sort of phenomenon. From the age of, 8 or 9, I was reading books about all this stuff, and I knew that someday I would write a book about these topics, but it's interesting because the point of view that I have now, it's much different from the one I had as a kid, you know, growing up. Then it was just all about the excitement and the mystery. My views are, you know, radically different now. I guess I have a much more adult perspective. Indeed, the tone of the book is often, you know, very skeptical, very cynical. I'm not denying that these mysteries, there's not anything to them. I'm just suggesting to people that they, you know, they need to view such things, you know, with a skeptical eye.
Right.
You don't want to breed, irrationality, which I think is a big problem nowadays.
Yeah, we had discussed a lot of things that they show on television.
And oh, sure, absolutely.
And how outrageous they are in order to get viewers. especially
sure.
The ghost hunters, things like that, yeah.
TV has become a really big culprit, and what's most disappointing is many of the channels that display this kinds of pseudosciences are, you know, supposedly, you know, educational channels. You know, the History Channel, the Learning Channel, Discovery, even the Animal Planet. I watched on Animal Planet this documentary about mermaids being discovered, and they even offered television footage of mermaids being caught, and the thing was, it was just so obviously it was computer generated. But this show, it was supposed to be completely serious. And, you know, it was about the fact that the mermaids had indeed been found. And the reason why the average person is not hearing about these amazing discoveries is because of some sort of government conspiracy.
Oh, wow.
You know, why governments would be trying to, you know, keeping under wraps the fact that mermaids have been found, that was never, you know, satisfactorily explained. But, you know, regardless, you know, it was obviously a hoax.
And yet so many people are so easily swayed by things that are obviously hoaxes. And all you need to do is show a little bit of fact, and then they skew everything else, and you've got people who believe it.
Oh, sure, absolutely. And one big problem is the fact that, you know, a lot of Animal Planet's viewers are children. And the way kids are nowadays is that when they see something on television, especially if it's a documentary type of program, they just immediately assume that this stuff is true. So when they see a TV show on an educational channel,
mm-hmm.
That's trying to prove that mermaids, you know, do exist, despite the fact that a human-fish hybrid is completely impossible. But if they see a series like that, that's claiming that mermaids are in fact real, chances are a lot of these kids are going to believe it. And so, you know, again, we touched on this earlier, but a lot of people, you know, particularly young people, are being seriously misled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's just, again, so much of it out there. Why do you think that people are latching on to things that aren't real?
I think part of the problem, and this is very ironic, modern communications. You would assume that modern technology, it would prove that people are advancing intellectually. But that doesn't seem to be the case at all. It seems like the hoaxers are actually using cutting-edge technology to spread false information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Internet has really played a major role in spreading hoaxes. Personally, I think we have another, you know, golden age of hoaxes coming up, thanks in part to the Internet. Only a year, maybe a year and a half ago, this happened in my home state of Georgia. Two men claimed that they had shot a Bigfoot, and they were showing it, you know, they made a video, and they posted it on YouTube. And it was obviously that this was a guy in a gorilla suit. But, you know, the thing went viral. And eventually these two men became mini celebrities. You know, they actually disappointed millions of people out there, because so many people, they just want to believe so badly that some sort of unknown ape is wandering around North America. They really dashed the hopes and dreams of a lot of people, but I don't think they care. They were looking to get their 15 minutes of fame, and
right.
That's exactly what they got.
Exactly, and that's a lot of people out there trying to do that. So they make up things or they sensationalize it.
Oh, sure, absolutely. So the Internet and cable TV, you know, they're playing major roles in, you know, presenting, you know, false information.
Right.
And a lot of people, you know, they're believing it.
Recently, I saw a video on the so-called zombie attack in Florida.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure you're probably not sure if you saw it, but from a camera view that was, you know, close to the bridge, you could see, you know, kind of two pairs of legs, but that's all you could see. And so, you know, here they are making this fact based on, you know, two men found on the bridge, one of them dead. Or both of them dead. Actually, both of them are dead.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So they, you know, here they're making it reality. They'd had no real proof to show. All they could show was, you know, something that was, you know, partly could have been anybody. Where was the proof? I saw no blood. I saw no evidence of it actually being a zombie. And if he was biting somebody, it could have nothing to do with being a zombie.
Oh, sure.
But we're so easy to, you know, so, oh my gosh, you know, the zombies really are, they're coming true, and they're going to be, you know, any day they're going to be walking around like the living dead. And going like, people, you know, there's got to be something more to that than we're seeing. And you guys need to ask the questions. Instead of asking the questions, they're assuming that it's true.
Oh, sure. Yeah. That reminds me that a few years ago, you know, Monster Quest, a series on the History Channel, a documentary series, was actually exploring a werewolf mystery in the United States.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny because In Search Of, I don't know if you remember that was a show hosted by Leonard Nimoy that was on, I don't know, late 70s, early to mid 80s.
Yeah.
And they did a show on werewolves, but they presented it as legend. And they were trying to, you know, explain why the werewolf myth originated. But this show on Monster Quest actually featured people who would claim to seeing werewolves, including people who were slowly changing into wolves.
Mm-hmm.
And that just really shows how irrational our contemporary society is becoming. It's basically an impossibility for a human to turn into a wolf. I mean, it's just not scientifically possible. And further, you know, there's no evidence to suggest that it could be happening. But I think ultimately what's prompting these sorts of series is because they're proven moneymakers. Shows like Ancient Aliens, even though they're not really shows about science or history, you know, they always get, you know, big ratings just because of sensationalism, you know, out there.
Right.
And I think that the people who are putting on these programs, they're putting, for one thing, I don't think they believe in this stuff, but they put it on anyway. Because, you know, they're
looking
really
to make money on
it. For it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But again,
you know, you have a lot of gullible people out there who's actually, you know, buying this stuff.
Well, you know, I was thinking about this since the last time we talked. And I was thinking that you're saying that we become more, where we're believing these things more. I don't think that we're believing them more now. Because, you know, countries were full of superstitious. You know, they have their superstitions really rampant in every country. And you've got, you know, your town people who believe that the castle up in the top of the hill is not only haunted but has a vampire. You know,
sure.
or the cabin at the end of the road. You know, they had a family who was massacred, so you know they got, you know, a killer running loose over there. So it's, you're going to have this folklore, I guess that's a good word for it, in every country throughout history. So I'm not sure if we believe it more now. I think that obviously media is causing us more of us to see these things instead of keeping them local. We're now seeing them outside of our local area.
Yeah. Well, you know, until I wrote my book, I would have, you know, agreed with you. But after doing the research, my personal feeling is that we're just drifting into, an era of irrationality. I don't know if it's disenchantment with a society that just seems to be dull or, you know, uninspiring, but it seems like, you know, in the past, and sure, you know, there's always been folklore, but the vast majority of people, and this, I guess this went on until maybe the late 1960s, what have you, they did not confuse folklore with reality. But these days you see that all the time. People who just assume that because these stories are old, you know, they have to be true.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, the legend of the vampire has existed for probably before the birth of Christ. And they just assume that because these legends are old, somehow they have to be true, which is, you know, which is bogus. But a lot of people don't seem to realize that.
Yeah, well, then, you know, if you look at history, you know, Vladimir the Impaler was a monster in the sense that he killed people unnecessarily. So,
sure.
You know, that doesn't make him a vampire.
No, not at all. But, yeah, a lot of people are confusing folklore and myth with reality, and that can be a scary thing. A lot of people find it amusing that so many people nowadays, they believe in ghouls and goblins and ghosts and all that. And again, I'm not standing firmly that, you know, these entities don't exist. I think it's highly unlikely. But, you know, I think we are drifting into an age of irrationality, and I find it scary because irrationalism can breed some pretty ugly things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for one thing, werewolf hunts, witch trials,
right.
You know, what have you. I mean, remember what happened, you know, back in Salem, Massachusetts.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if you're not using, you know, rationality, suddenly anything becomes possible. All things are possible.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's not such a good thing. I mean, there's not much of a leap in saying, you know what, werewolves, they exist. And there's not much of a leap to saying, well, you know, all Jews are bad. Do you see where I'm going with this?
Oh, yeah.
Irrationality can just take so many forms.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the irrationality concerning the Jews, you know, led to the Holocaust. So,
exactly.
You know, it's not necessarily, you know, so amusing. Sometimes irrationality, I mean, it's a very, very scary thing. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to tie those, you know, what people are believing in, and then you have the opposite way. I've heard of many who don't even believe the Holocaust even came to pass. And I'm going, well, how can you not believe something that's not only in the history books, but it is blatantly, you know, inscripted almost a lot of places. There's a lot of proof for it, yet you'll believe, you know, that Bigfoot is in your backyard.
Yeah.
You know, it's so skewed. You got people who won't believe something that definitely happened. Same thing, you know, goes with, you know, people who believe that we never landed on the moon. Yeah.
Oh, sure.
I can, you know, there's no real proof of us not being there, and yet there is proof that that we were there. Why would we possibly make that into the biggest hoax possible? There's no real reason for it. The same thing with the Holocaust. Why would we make that stuff up? And yet there's so many people who were proven to have died at that time.
I came to the conclusion that, you know, again, it's all wish fulfillment. You know, they believe what they want to believe because the alternative just seems to be so painful. I think with a lot of these individuals, a lot of them, you know, they had ancestors who lived in Germany at the time. And I think a lot of it was just fear that maybe their ancestors, that members of their own family, you know, were involved in genocide. And they don't want to believe in the Holocaust because it's too painful. They don't want to admit to the fact that maybe members of their own family, the ancestors,
right.
you know, committed absolutely brutal things.
Right. That would make that would make Grandpa a monster.
Yeah, I'm absolutely sure. Yeah.
That's too close to that.
Now, that doesn't explain all of Holocaust deniers, but it does explain, you know, at least some of them. A lot of people, they want to believe that the white race just could not have committed, you know, anything that that horrific. But you're right. World War II and the Holocaust are probably the two most widely documented events in human history. So it is very, very, you know, bizarre that these Holocaust deniers are out there. What really concerns me is that the numbers just seem to be growing. I remember when I was researching, you know, for the Holocaust, you know, on the internet, and you would Google the word Holocaust, and I was absolutely shocked by how many Holocaust denial websites there were. What also surprised me was that the content on these websites was actually very, very sophisticated. The writing was fairly good. The graphics were very good. If a high school child was to stumble upon these websites, and because they are so sophisticated, they might have doubts that the Holocaust, you know, actually existed. Just because these websites look so professional. We'd like to think that neo-Nazis, you know, they're just stupid hooligans without any education who can't read or write, or, you know, they're basically just laughable. You know, that's not the case at all.
No.
One of the founders of the neo-Nazi movement in America, he wrote the Turner Diaries. I can't think of his name, but he was, you know, far from the stereotype. You know, he possessed a doctorate. We're talking about a very well-educated man.
Right. And we do hear a lot about actually the Nazis and the, you know, the SS specifically being very intelligent, well-educated people. So, you know, it only goes to show that, you know, if they're following a line of succession, and that we still have, you know, families from them now, and they've got, you know, their own websites. Yeah, they're going to look professional because these are professional people.
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of them. I remember when I was, you know, sending out emails to, you know, radio hosts. I'm sure you're familiar with the process. You have a book to promote, so you send out emails talking about your book to radio hosts. And radio hosts are generally people who have a lot of, you know, influence. And they're usually very articulate, you know, often well-educated. And I received an email back from this individual. He told me straight up that he would not have me on his show because I was a Jewish propagandist, and I asked him, you know, why would I be a Jewish propagandist? And he sent me an email saying that everybody knows that the Holocaust was a myth, which is very, very chilling.
Yeah,
particularly because this was a man. His show was about books. All right. This is obviously a man who's well educated, you know, a certain level of refinement, but, you know, he's going on air telling his listeners that, you know, the Holocaust was a myth. It was very, very chilling. And, you know, this is a person with a certain level of influence.
Yeah.
And, you know, because he's a member of the media, you know, people are going to believe him.
Right, right. Although I think sometimes we see where that particular authority has been abused, especially recently.
Oh, sure, absolutely, absolutely.
We do tend to believe people, but I think part of that is changing. I start questioning what our journalists are saying, which is it should have been a long time ago, but. But,
yeah.
You know, it should be done now. And because, again, as soon as they open their mouth, they say things that aren't true, or they make it appear as if, you know, they know what you're talking about when they don't. So I totally agree with you. I understand what you're talking about there. And that is a shame because, you know, if he's going to spread something like that, technically it shouldn't be spread at all. I'm surprised that some people in journalism like that don't watch a little closer what they say and how they say it.
Yeah,
considering the true happiness of some people.
Yeah. And I think what I found most chilling was the fact that this guy was a true believer. He wasn't just trying to be outrageous.
Yeah.
That I found very, very scary.
And he didn't really have any proof, though, did he? Just blind faith that the Holocaust isn't real.
Yeah, that was it. And it's very, very interesting. You know, I'm a Southerner. I was born in Georgia, raised in Georgia. You know, I have relatives who to this day insist that, you know, the Civil War had absolutely nothing to do with slavery, you know, which is
right.
Just a massive misconception. And I think that again is, you know, you're not comfortable with the truth, so you just try to deny the truth. A lot of whites in the South, particularly older ones, they don't want to accept the fact that, you know, maybe their ancestors were slave owners, maybe they were segregationists, you know, what have you. So I'm very much, you know, used to this, you know, this blatant, you know, disregard for the truth. You know, you're not comfortable with the truth, so, you know, you deny it as much as you can. And it's just interesting. The more you give them evidence, the more shrill they become about denying, you know, the evidence. It just seems to spur them on all the more.
Right. Right, and... I'm going to take a slight break here and let everybody know that you can call in. The guest call number is 714-242-5145. I know a lot of you are listening to this show after the fact, so why not, you know, listen to them now and call in and ask questions or comment. You know, it should not just be a two-sided thing here. We definitely have the phone open, and that's what it's there for. So 714-242-5145. Please call on and let us know what you think about our subjects. Now, I wanted to go over with you where you found the Murderous Intellectuals came out a few years ago, and how did you go about deciding this is the subject you wish to talk about, and then how did you do the research?
Well, as far as the research, it wasn't particularly, you know, glamorous. I did go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., which was a very moving experience. Most of the time, I just spent in libraries. And I'm sure that a lot of authors, you know, particularly nonfiction authors, you know, they can relate to that. I always had an interest in the Holocaust. I'm not exactly sure why. By the time I was in high school, you know, I was reading book after book about the Holocaust. And, you know, as wonderful as these books were, you know, I saw a problem that I thought was that had never really been addressed before. You know, the popular stereotype of the Nazi, it was, you know, some sort of mindless thug who generally lived on the fringes of society. But, you know, as I was researching about the Nazis, I found so many who did not, you know, fit the profile. These were individuals who came from the middle class. Some of them came from the upper class. Some were, you know, superbly educated. They actually possessed, you know, advanced degrees. And I had so much curiosity about this, but no author seemed to really explore it in depth. So eventually, you know, I just decided to write a book about the topic myself. And what I found was pretty amazing. Originally, I was just going to address maybe, you know, 10 prominent Nazis, you know, who at the same time were intellectuals, but at the same time people who were murderers and torturers and sadists. But, you know, I literally found, you know, thousands of these types of individuals. The SS, the Schutzstaffel, the group that spearheaded the Holocaust, was actually a very, very elite organization. One-third of their officers, you know, possessed a bachelor's degree. This was at a time when maybe, you know, 2% of the German population or the European population had any sort of, you know, college training. So we're actually talking about, you know, a very elite organization, and it was full of doctors and lawyers and scientists and educators. It's not at all what you would expect.
So you've spent a lot of time in libraries. Any specific library in your town, or did you have to go outside of the country? Did you have to look up things outside, you know, in Germany?
A little bit, but, you know, most of the books that I use, they just came from local libraries, in Cartersville, Georgia, which is nearby, Rome, Georgia. I found some good materials in Mobile, Alabama. I was staying there for a little while. But, yeah, most of it was just, you know, very, very unglamorous work. Just a lot of, you know, hard work in libraries. You know, it's not something that's all that interesting to talk about.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, it's something that has to be done.
Right, exactly. I was talking about that. Kind of like archaeology, where I spent a lot of time in the library instead of not really out there actually digging up anything.
Sure, yeah.
And so it's the same thing. Authors have to spend a lot of time to you know, research their subjects before they can put it out in book. So especially if that, with people who don't believe what you're saying, do you keep a lot of information, like you know, referenced, so that way if anybody really comes, you know, gets belligerent with you, can you go back and show them, you know, send them some of the documentation on that? Or do you bother?
No, I was always very, very careful with, you know, the documentation. That's one thing. The Holocaust is just something, if you're presenting a history of it, you know, you need to get the facts straight. Because, you know, if you're careless with the information, you're really dishonoring all the people who died during the Holocaust or all the people who suffered during the Holocaust. So, you know, you want to get your facts right.
So I know one of the questions that someone asked me to ask you is, what happened to Hitler, or what was your theory?
You mean would Hitler die in the bunker?
Right.
Oh yeah, that's another major hoax. We can't seem to get away from hoaxes. He had a suicidal wish. He knew that the Third Reich, it was done for. Russian soldiers were only not even a mile away, maybe a quarter of a mile. So he actually wrote a suicide letter, his wife took poison, and then he killed himself with a handgun. And SS officers, they burned Hitler's body, and they burned his wife's body. And this has all been clearly documented. There is a little mystery about what happened to the remains of Hitler. Some believe that the Russians were able to find the burnt remains and just try to conceal the fact. There is some evidence there. There's not a lot of it, but there is evidence that they might have found the charred remains. But as far as Hitler mistaking, as far as Hitler faking his own death, there's actually no evidence for that. Hitler, his mental health was in serious decline. Living in the bunker, knowing that the Russians and the Americans and the British were overrunning Germany and there was no hope for the Third Reich, he was terrified that the Russians would get him while alive. He was very much afraid that his fate would be very much like Benito Mussolini's, who was, basically lynched. And, where was he going to go? The Russians were moving in from the east. The British and the Americans were moving in from the west. He was trapped in this, suffocating bunker. Where was he going to go?
Right.
So basically, the only way out for him was suicide, which he took.
Well, if you're going to kill that many people, he obviously had no worries or cares about humanity or his own humanity. So, it was pretty easy for him, I think, to take his own life at that point. I mean, like you said, he was hot on all sides at that point.
Yeah, there wasn't much, hope for Hitler. And the same can be said for most of the other major Nazi figures. Now, Joseph Mengele was an exception. He did manage to get away. In fact, quite a number of SS officers were able to get away. But Joseph Mengele, during the war, he was actually a very, very obscure figure. Contrary to popular myth, he never associated with Hitler. Hitler probably had no idea who he was. He was basically just an officer who was operating at the middle management levels. He wasn't a top figure like
right.
Hitler or Himmler or Goering. He really wasn't on the radar at the time. So actually a great number of less well-known Nazi officers were able to escape, but individuals like Himmler or Hitler, it was very, very hard for them to escape.
was because basically everybody knew who they were, and everybody was well aware of the serious crimes that they had committed. So in a lot of ways, you know, it's rather misleading to try to group someone like Mengele in with Hitler.
So you know, this book, that Murderous Intellectuals, is more serious apparently. More serious, where you're saying that your Piltdown Man and other hoaxes was more lighthearted.
Yeah, basically anything is lighthearted after you've written a book about the Holocaust.
What's your?
I have to admit, as much as I enjoyed researching and writing Murderous Intellectuals, the whole project left me exhausted. Although the subject matter was just so depressing that I promoted the book heavily for about 3 years, and I just wanted to move on, really. And part of the reasons why I wrote Piltdown Man and Other Hoaxes is just because it was such a big departure. Because it, was, significantly more lighthearted than, the first book. I just wanted to get away from something that was so depressing. That being said, unintentionally, I actually touched upon a number of very serious things in Piltdown Man and Other Hoaxes. We're still arguing about creationism and religious fundamentalism. You know, who's right? Are the evolutionists correct? Are the religious traditionalists correct? We still talk, heavily about race. Quite unintentionally, I stumbled into some really, really serious things and took down my other hoaxes, but in comparison with my first book, it was a big departure. Maybe not actually, but as far as tone, I suppose.
Well, what's next for you now that you have talked about Holocaust and now you've talked about a lot of hoaxes? What's next for you?
Right now, I'm promoting my second book very heavily. I had a radio interview last night, radio interview tonight. This is actually more about Murderous Intellectuals, but I've got another interview tomorrow night. So I'm staying busy. It's funny, sometimes just the marketing and the promoting of your book, really and truly, that's just as demanding as researching and writing.
I know you're finishing out school, so does what you're writing, are you able to use it in your studies?
Oh, sure, absolutely. But even with all my experience as a writer, I still find the schoolwork to be very, very challenging. To tell you the truth, the first couple of months I was in grad school, I rather felt shell-shocked by the whole experience, just by, how demanding the workload is. But, it's been very, very satisfying. And this fall semester is going to be my last semester. On the one hand, I'm very much looking forward to it because I want to go ahead and get my doctorate. But at the same time, I would just like to stay where I am just because I find classes so enjoyable.
I am finding you online. I went ahead and put up your Facebook page so everyone can find you. And I'm going to be putting up your website here at the Maxwell Studios. That's not you, is it?
No.
It's got Maxwell. It's, yeah. Where do they find your books other than Amazon?
Barnes & Noble.
That everywhere?
Yeah.
Okay. Definitely going to put those up there for you. We have some kind of a bad connection, so I'm going to be cutting off here a little bit short, but I was hoping that it would clear up, and it's not. I think that we were talked before about a little more detail on the different, you know, characters that you have that you've gone through to researched. Is there anything that you haven't researched that you thought maybe should have been in the book?
It was the first one or the second one?
I would say the Filthdown Man.
That was definitely the Scientology, which incidentally is really in the news right now because Katie Holmes, you know, left Tom Cruise, and more than likely it was because of Scientology, which is actually, you know, a very, very bizarre organization. I would definitely refer to it as a cult, and not only as a cult, but also as a hoax, because the founder of Scientology was a science fiction writer, and he actually told an audience that, you know, writing for a pulp magazine was a stupid thing to do. If a man really wants to become rich, he should start his own religion. Now, at the time, everybody thought he was just joking, but you know what? He wasn't. He actually did start his own religion that now has probably at least 100,000 followers, although officially Scientology says that they have more than 10 million followers. I think it's actually much, much smaller. But I've been doing some research on Scientology, and it's actually been just an absolute massive fraud. It looks like that L. Ron Hubbard was just a complete charlatan. He made a fortune by selling a fraudulent religion. And most of his claims are just obviously bogus. It's amazing that anybody, you know, can believe him, but apparently a lot of people do. But in his book, Dianetics, he claimed that if you adopt my religion, you know, you can cure yourself of cancer, you can cure yourself of any mental illness. You can cure any sort of phobia or anxiety. You know, if you spend really good money on my religion, you can actually fly, you can actually, you know, practice faith healing, that you can move inanimate objects. And it looks, you know, pretty obvious that he knew that he was a hoaxer and a charlatan, but, you know, he marketed something that people wanted to believe in, and he made, you know, a fortune doing it.
Right.
And, you know, he became a very famous man for doing what he did. And Scientology, I wish I had examined that in my book. Generally, when it comes to my second book, I'm pretty satisfied with it. But, you know, there's some information that I, looking back on it, I should have included.
What's the difference between that genocide and some of the genocide going on right now?
genocides, individually there are going to be differences, but generally genocides are sparked by the same things, and right now they are genocides that are supposed to be going on in Tibet and in Darfur for Africa. But generally genocides happen when people are poor or desperate. They don't have jobs, they're hungry, they don't know how to feed their families, and they're looking for scapegoats. That's really how, you know, Holocaust happened. In World War II, it was the Jews who were the scapegoats. In Cambodia, where genocide occurred in the 1970s, it was supposedly people who were allegedly disloyal to the communist regime. In the former, you know, Yugoslavia, you know, it was ethnic group against ethnic group. We would call it, you know, one another ethnic group. So whenever you find, you know, hopelessness or powerlessness, you know, there's always going to be the possibility for genocide. And we also have to acknowledge the fact that human beings, you know, unless it's you know, countered somehow by, I suppose, education, people can do really horrific things to one another.
Yeah,
sometimes,
sure.
You know, simply because of sadistic impulses.
Yeah, and if you see history, that's definitely true. You know, the English have done a lot of things, persecuted a lot of different countries in the name of civilizing them. So, you know, that's in history.
Oh, yeah. If you look at history, you know, sadly, it just seems to be, you know, a history of man's inhumanity to man. Sometimes, well, oftentimes, you know, reading about history, it's just very depressive. Just because, you know, human beings, time and time again, you know, they display their inhumanity to one another. And sadly, I don't think it's improving. You know, we'd like to think that we're more civilized now, but if you take an objective of accounting of what's going on right now, it looks like, you know, we aren't progressing morally. You know, we have a war going on in Afghanistan with apparently no end in sight. The Americans withdrew from Iraq, but the problems in Iraq is still going on. There are rumors about Iraq descending into civil war. You know, we still have problems with race in this country, in supposedly the freest country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. You could argue that morally we're progressing. Sadly, I don't agree with that, and I think that the facts seem to be, you know, on my side.
It was kind of interesting. My son just graduated from high school, and he spent a lot of time, especially in the senior year, they specifically really delved into the Holocaust, and I mean, to the point where he said it was getting kind of ridiculous how much material they were, you know, and how many movies and how many shows they were watching to prove that the Holocaust actually existed. And I talked to one of the teachers, and he said that it's because they eschewed it so much that, you know, they the kids nowadays weren't believing that it ever happened. So they have to, it's like overcompensating.
Yeah, yeah. And
I thought, well, you know, I should bring that up to you when I talk to you next.
Yeah, and, you know, regardless of, you know, how often it's studied, you know, the number of Holocaust deniers is still growing.
Yeah.
In part because so many of the witnesses so many of the survivors, whether they were perpetrators or victims or bystanders, you know, they're gone. You know, the war has been over for, you know, almost 70 years, so, you know, many of the people who participated, the people who are around, you know, they're gone.
Right.
And so, you know, you've got a problem there. But the crux of it, I think that the big problem is a lot of people that they don't want to see the truth, because for them the truth is too painful. And because they find the truth so painful, you know, again, they just deny it. So there's something much more, you know, going on there. It's not that these people are stupid. It's just the fact that they have problems accepting truth. And if you look at history again, you see that, that's always been a problem. You know, even here in America, which supposedly prides itself on its, you know, transparency, Americans like to believe that we're always the good guy. Now, that was the case in World War II, but oftentimes, you know, sadly, Americans have been, you know, anything but the good guy. Look what we did to blacks. Look at what we did to, you know, Native Americans. The Americans, you know, actually practiced their own version of chemical warfare to wipe out Indians. They would visit an Indian tribe, and as evidence of their, you know, good faith or what have you, they would present the Indian tribe with gifts, such as blankets. And the Indians eagerly accepted these gifts and believed that the whites, you know, had no, you know, malicious intentions toward them. What they didn't know is that these blankets or what have you, these gifts, were all infected with smallpox germs. And so 3 weeks, the entire tribe would be devastated. So, you know, the Americans actually practice their own versions of chemical warfare, germ warfare.
And of course, that's just happening more and more often now.
Yeah, absolutely. And you would think the technology, you know, because it is so advanced, that technology would be used for, you know, positive ends. But no, you know, that has been the case all too often. You know, technology, cutting-edge technology, has been used to kill one another. I guess the atomic bomb and the hydrogen bomb would be, you know, prime examples of that. And another thing to prove that the Nazis were not stupid, The Nazis, they were really, really innovative when it came to technology. It was the Nazis that came up, you know, with the first jet aircraft. They were the first ones to use, you know, extensive rockets. Much of the Americans' knowledge about, you know, rockets and space travel actually came from the Nazis, because, you know, they're pioneering this. So you have a brilliant people, and you know, they're able to develop, you know, all this cutting edge technology, but at the same time, I mean, morally, they're absolutely primitive. We like to think that technology and morality go hand in hand, but oftentimes that's not the case at all.
Right. And that's so what would you suggest that people should be on the lookout for as far as, you know, trying to sway somebody who doesn't believe that these things have come to pass?
That's the problem. Oftentimes, these individuals, they're very fanatical. Regardless of what evidence you present to them, you know, they're going to deny it. And oftentimes, their arguments, as fallacious as they are, the arguments actually seem very, very sophisticated. Oftentimes, you know, they present the view that the Jews are, you know, financially profiting from, you know, the lie of the Holocaust, you know. And a lot of people are, you know, they believe it.
Right.
That's the tragedy of it all. Just because that irrationality can be a very, very strong thing. And that these people, they are being very, very irrational. But, you know, again, irrationality, it can be very, very strong. It can be very, very powerful. Simon Wiesenthal, the old, you know, Nazi hunter, suggested that these individuals should be satirized and humiliated as often as possible.
Yeah.
Ridicule to make these people ashamed of their beliefs. But, you know, that sort of recourse has actually backfired because a lot of the people,
a lot of the deniers were being claimed that they were being maliciously persecuted. So, you know, that tactic, I guess you could say, has failed somewhat. So it's really still a mystery about, you know, what to do with such people. Because, you know, on the one hand, you know, they have a First Amendment right to believe what they want to believe.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, they're lying to people. Germany actually has laws if you deny the Holocaust publicly, you can actually go to jail. But that hasn't stopped the deniers. Personally, I think censorship in any form is bad. So, you know, I wish I could give you a good answer, but sadly, I don't think that there is one. I think that one of the effective methods is, you know, just through education. But some people, they don't want to be educated.
No. They want to believe in the hoaxes, and they want to believe that the Holocaust never existed for whatever reason.
Yeah. And sometimes there can be a variety of reasons.
Yeah. I say the same thing about people who believe we never made it on the moon. But, you know, there is no swaying people who already have their blanket set.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, I mean, their reasoning can appear to be very, very sophisticated.
No, and it goes a long way for a lot of different things, including UFOs. I mean, you know, the list has gone on. So there are so many things that people are not believing in, or people are believing in, that are, you know, ludicrous, really.
Yeah, crop circles are actually an excellent example, because around the late 80s through the middle 90s, people started coming forward and saying that, you know, we're behind the crop circles. During the night, we would create the crop circles using primitive farm equipment. And it was all done in fun. They were just pranksters. You know, they would just, you know, play a clever practical joke. But, you know, it snowballed in ways that they never anticipated. And so you had this group of people who still believe in crop circles, believing that there's something extraordinary going on, and hoaxes have actually come and admitted, hey, we're behind the hoax.
Yeah.
You know, we're behind the myth. we actively admit that what we did was a hoax, but they still don't believe it. They want to believe in something remarkable and mysterious and freakish. And so the more they're presented with evidence that this is a hoax, the more it comes back and say, no, no, we're convinced it's UFOs or cults or what have you. And, you know, it's still going on today. And I just find it interesting that even though there's so much evidence to just say conclusively, you know, crop circles, they're just hoax, people go on believing what they want to believe.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, it does have a lot to do with religion. I mean, religion's part of that. You know, some people are so swayed on one way or the other. And it's kind of the same thing. So it does go down to your belief system.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
That's an entirely different subject.
Yeah.
We get somebody calling in for that one for sure. But anyway, that was the only question that came in. So I am going to close it off. It is a little after the hour. And we're still getting some kind of connection problem. I think it has to do with some weather between here and you. So I know we've been having a lot of dust storms here in Arizona. We've got our monsoons early this year. So
yeah.
So with that, I thank you for your time again. This has always been very interesting and you know, these kind of things we sit around and talk about, you know?
Sure. I'll have to come back for a third time one of these days.
There you go. When you get something that you're researching, you want to bounce it off somebody, just give me a call.
Okay, that sounds great.
It's been really nice talking to you, and with that, I'm going to say goodnight.
All right, thanks again.
Thanks. That was Jonathan Maxwell, and this is Patty Holstrand. I'm going to take a brief break, and then I'm going to go over some different shows that are coming up soon. Patty Holstrand is at K-World Radio, and I just wanted to go over some of our shows coming up tomorrow. We've got Alexander Glant, and you can find a lot of information on him right on my blog. And that is, did I get it open? Okay. Alexander. His book is called Depths of Deception, and it's a Titanic fiction. Here's 1982, and a beautiful young woman dressed in Edwardian clothing is found floating unconscious in the North Atlantic and with a 1912 boarding pass to the RMS Titanic. Over in England, an insurance investigator is assigned the case of the missing brooch that was stolen during a horrific unsolved murder in 1909, Glasgow. He is chosen because of his own grandfather who had botched the original investigation. Despite the painful family memory and likelihood that all evidence will be long gone, the investigator dives in as he begins to uncover an entangled truth that the missing brooch may have ended up in the ill-fated RMS Titanic. Someone is one step ahead trying to stop him. So it sounds like really good intrigue. It's got obviously a mystery. And it's all centered around the historical Titanic. So he and I were discussing, as Jonathan Maxwell and I had to discuss, how he goes about researching his historical facts in order to make sure that what he's writing is as close to nonfiction in his fiction that he can. So that's tomorrow night, same time, same bat channel. 5:30 p.m. That'd be 8:30 Eastern Time. And then we will have another virtual book tour with Chet Shoup. We had talked to him a few months ago on our station, and he's had a nonfiction book, Eden, and about the loss of intimacy in our society. Definitely worth the information if you didn't understand what this book was about during the show. Definitely take a look on my blog, and I'm going to leave that information on the blog. That way you guys can find it. Again, the information on Alexander Gallant is a couple days old, so you'll need to scroll down. But definitely worth reading because he's got a little short guest blog on there as well, and obviously some excerpts from his book. So definitely cool. He has won an award for his research work, and a lot of you guys who are really interested in the vampires would definitely want to listen to that episode with him tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we also have another VBT, another virtual book tour with M.K. McClintock. And she's on her second book in her series called Gallagher's Hope. And then on Friday, a very good friend of mine, a local Arizona author from Sierra Vista, Arizona, Weston Osh, is going to be on with us. And you guys are really going to want to listen to that conversation. He's very articulate and knows a lot of information. He writes horror, and I know a lot of you are interested in that subject. And he will discuss why horror writers are some of the sanest people he knows. So, with that, I'm going to say goodnight. We've quite a bit of things this week, and next week won't be quite so heavy, but then the week after we'll definitely have a lot going on. So, we'll see you tomorrow night, 5:30 p.m. here. And that's 5:30 the Mountain Time, as well as Arizona Time, and 8:30 Eastern Time. So, with that, I'm going to say goodnight. This is Patty Hallstrand, and signing out for KWOD Radio.